Hello, and welcome to the September minicast for the Narrator Show. The first story I wanted to share with you is from Robert Rutherford, who is one of my favorite storytellers and writers. He's a music writer who contributes to the Onion's AV Club, and he's sharing a story that he told on the live show last year, but he came over and recorded it for me one-on-one. So this is Robert Rutherford.
I'm standing in my kitchen holding a letter informing me that I'm being sued by a creditor for failure to make my car payments for the last 6 months. And I walk into the kitchen and my heart is throbbing in my neck. And I start opening drawers. I find the drawer that holds all of our silverware. And I start digging around looking for the sharpest knife I can find. Maybe a chef's knife or a meat cleaver. And the closest thing I can find is a dull serrated paring knife. It's about 3 inches long, the blade set into a plastic handle. And I put that in my pocket and I leave the house and I go get into my newly acquired 1989 cherry red Ford Festiva and head towards Brighton, Colorado, where I am going to find Bradley Lucero Jr. and stab him about the face and neck for ruining my life. But I'm going to tell this story backwards because I think it's more important to point out all of the steps that brought me to that point. So the Ford Festiva that I was driving had been given to me by my mother just a week prior, replacing the car that I had on loan from a friend while he spent the summer traveling around Europe. The Festiva is a tiny little turd of a car. It's like the car that's made from the leavings of larger cars. It's the vehicular equivalent of owning a Lisp. And I had accepted this car from my mother somewhat ashamedly and gratefully because I needed a car. The Ford had recently taken a fair amount of damage to its front end. The headlight was held in place by a stick from a scrub oak tree and copious amounts of duct tape, and the whole front quarter panel was crumpled in against the frame. And even with the stick and the duct tape, the headlight kind of wobbled constantly and threatened to pop out at any moment. My mother had been in a head-on collision just a couple weeks prior, and in an odd moment of confluence, it happened that I was the driver of the other vehicle in the Chevy Cavalier that my friend had loaned me while he toured around Europe. But I'm going to back up even further. So there's this weird moment when I got into the accident with my mother where I'm kind of trying to get my wits about me in the aftermath, and she is across from me. It was a head-on collision. We were right outside of our home, so the odds were pretty favorable that if two cars were going to run into each other, it would have been two that we were driving. And at that time, I just kind of figured, like, well, this is just my luck that I would get into a car accident with my mother. And I wasn't really taking a lot of responsibility for any of my actions at the time. And this, you know, added to that. And it was just her fault, and her fault alone. And she sat in the car and took the keys out of the ignition and lit a cigarette and opened the door and popped her head out and just said, "Honey, I'm home." It was pretty funny. I had the Chevy Cavalier on loan from a friend because I had just sold a car after determining that it was an expense that I couldn't afford as I entered into college. I had been trying to muster up the courage to get back into school for a while and had finally decided that I would try to get myself a degree in English. I had applied to Metro State College in Denver because I knew that they couldn't turn me away simply because of my status as an idiot. I didn't have really good grades, but they didn't really look at that. They just kind of were taking all comers. my years of working at the mall had kind of left me pretty cynical and ready for a change in my station in life, so I figured college would be a good place to take a stab at that. I'm going to back up a little further and say that the car that I had sold was a 1993 Geo Metro convertible. It was bone white with AM, FM, CD player, four speakers. It was pretty highfalutin for a kid my age, and not very cool at all. It was, after all, a white two-door Geo Metro convertible. It was like a cheerleader car. The other Geo that was popular at the time was the Geo Storm, which was like the flagship car of every stripper in America. I had only owned the car for a couple months when I decided to go back to school, so I decided that I would sell it. I posted an ad in the Denver Post, and less than a week later, I met Bradley Lucero Jr., who was an assistant manager of a Comfort Inn in Brighton. And he called me and asked if we could meet for a test drive. When we met, he had his two-month-old daughter and his fiancée in tow, and we spent the better part of an afternoon together. We really liked each other. He seemed to have a good understanding of my situation and really liked the car, and so he felt, you know, through the conversation and the test drive that we could work something out. So what we agreed upon in handwriting was that he would assume payments of the car with the bank and take the car that day. So I handed him the keys and he loaded his happy young family into the car and drove off, and that was it. I had his phone number and I knew that he worked at a Comfort Inn in Brighton. So as the months wore on, punctuated by all of these angry phone calls from bill collectors and piling mail laying out the course of actions that were being mounted against me in my delinquency, my own frequent calls to Bradley Lucero's house became more frantic and more desperate. And in short, he just gave me the total blow off. And the more I told my story, my side of the story of the car sale to older people and people who had a little bit more wisdom on their side, they pretty much told me straight up that I had done something really stupid. I called the cops and told them the story, but there was no recourse that they could pursue because I had willingly handed over the keys to him. So that was that, even though we had an agreement. So it wasn't theft, it wasn't anything. So the impetus for shedding the car, again, was because it was an expense that I couldn't afford when I went back to school. So I was trying to do something good for myself. And as all of this started to mount and I had court dates set up where I'd have to go claim delinquency or figure out something with the bank, I just felt like I had failed to do anything good for myself in all of this. But I want to back up even just a little further because I think it's where the point of this story resides. I bought the car because I had been afforded a pretty decent salary as an assistant manager of a Vans shoe outlet store in Castle Rock, Colorado. At the age of 19, I felt like I had risen to a station that was pretty sweet. I was an assistant manager, so I had like a printed name tag, and I got pretty sweet discounts on shoes, and I got to control the VCR that played all of the looping skate music videos during my shift. I got to provide direction to all the part-time clerks. No hiring or firing abilities, but I carried a pretty big stick. And I sat in the food court one day and perused the classifieds looking for a car. I felt that since I had risen to this station as assistant manager of a Vans, that I deserved something for myself, and so a car would be a means of asserting my status with all of the cute part-time clerks. So I found this Geo Metro advertised, and the price seemed ridiculously low for a car that had such low miles. So I called the dealership that had placed the ad and played it really cool about the price, thinking that it was a misprint or something. And I, when I went to see the car, I brought the classified so that I would have something in print to prove that the price was as advertised and that they would be forced to sell it to me at that low price. And when I got there and kind of made a stink about it, feeling really assertive, they were like, "Oh, I guess we have to sell it to you at that price then." When really it was exactly how much the car should have been sold for, if not a little more. But they acted like they were going to have a real hard time letting go of it for that price, but fair was fair. So that's what we settled on, and I bought it. I bought the car. I bought the status with the name tag. I bought all of it. So months later, as I'm pulling into this Comfort Inn parking lot where Bradley Lucero Jr. works and I cut the engine, I'm sitting there and I leave the lights on and the radio on, and I'm just staring at the hotel, and the wiper blades are pushing rain off and on the windshield and streaking my view of the hotel. And I just sit there listening to the radio and turning around to this tiny little dull serrated paring knife in my pocket, staring at the hotel, and I had no idea what to do. And I sat there for the better part of an afternoon, and it started to get dark and stopped raining, and the sky started clearing, and I just turned this knife over and over and over again in my pocket, practically digging into the seam, and I had no idea what to do.
That was Robert Rutherford. Your next story is from the narrator's live open mic show. This is Devin Davis. It was his first time doing the show, and he just shares a short story that he didn't actually intend to share. He intended to tell a story about jail, but I told a story about jail. So he sort of thought of this story last minute, and I really enjoyed it. And I think sometimes the best stories come just last minute when your brain has to sort of jog itself, and you just recall a story. And he just sort of popped out this story, and I really enjoyed it. This is Devin Davis.
I was actually broken up with last week. I was dating a girl and she broke up with me. And like, whatever, wasn't too worried about it. But it hit me this week. Like, it hit me like in the middle of this week. Actually, Monday, this is not the middle of the week. I went to 7-Eleven and grabbed a Big Gulp and a brownie, an extra pack of cigarettes, and I just worked through whatever I needed to work through. I'm going to reference that later, so I'm giving you guys the point of what's happening. So, my mom raised me by herself, okay? She's a single mom, bipolar mom, and she taught me, like, everything I know about how to be a boy, like, how to be a nice boy, you know, like, realistically, it wasn't a lot of good things instilled, like, because she was bipolar, it was a bunch of, like, manic episodes every now and again. So she was like, every now, like, the lesson I would get occasionally was, well, you're feeling good, let's clean and go buy some new clothes. You know, like, that's not really, it's not a good lesson. Fast forward a couple years, and me and my friend are, we're playing the new Madden back in the time. So a new Madden game comes out, and we're sitting there, like, just jonesing, you know, dude playing the game. And I get a call from her husband, and he's like, "Devin, I know you're probably doing something, and I'm really sorry I have to call you and interrupt whatever's going on, but I've been looking for your mom for an hour, and I can't find her at all." So what had happened was that my mom was in the hospital because she was having a miscarriage. So she went to the hospital, like, she didn't know what was going on, but she ended up miscarrying. And that's really dark and really horrifying, and I apologize, but I figure I might as well just tell you guys the truth about what happened. You know, she was eventually distraught, is what happens. Women have feelings and eventually get angry and leave hospitals, is what I learned from that. And so she leaves and runs away, and her husband can't find her. But I also found out later that her husband was just being a complete and total jerk. Like, he wasn't, like, abusing her or anything like that, but, like, he was equally as angry which I guess is what happens. So people, like, once you lose... For me, it didn't affect me as much because I thought I was going to have a brother, and I didn't. So that was really sad, really kind of awkward for me. But, you know, he called me because he was just out of options. He was really mad at himself, and he was really embarrassed, and I really felt for him. And it's my mom. Like, I have to go help. So 5 games of Madden later, we get up. We get in a truth. 5 games of Madden later. So that means we've... Another 2 hours passed. Another 2 hours passed, and I won every game, so don't worry. It wasn't a complete loss. We leave, and we go, and we start driving down to Denver General, because it's where it was at, and like, my mom was obviously on foot. She wasn't really going far. We're driving down there, and I sit there, and I tell my buddy who's driving, and I'm like, hey, swing by this. Swing down over here. And again, just to remind you, my mom taught me a lot of things. One of the things she taught me eventually is, and what I learned out of this instance, was that when just shit isn't going your way, when things aren't cool and you just need a pick-me-up, my mom always would go to 7-Eleven and, like, grab a big gulp and a brownie. So just remember. So we go down there, and I'm like, swing by this 7-Eleven real fast. And, like... We see my poor mom, like, she has pants on and like the like a shirt, but she still has her hospital gown with her, and she had mascara running, and it was so touching and so sad, and like I was just so happy to see my mom safe, you know. But like that was the first thing I thought, but then I saw that she in fact had a brownie and a big gulp. And I started laughing, and I walked up to her, and I was like, huh, brownie and a big gulp, huh? And she started laughing and told me to go fuck myself. Like, that was... That's my mama. What's kind of cool about that is that I realized that me being a fat kid isn't hereditary anymore. Like, she just taught me through sorrow to eat my feelings away. So, that's good. And that was, like, one of the weirdest, like, bonding times she and I had. We sat out there for half an hour. My poor friend was sitting in the car the entire time, and I was sitting out there talking and bonding with my mom in the weirdest possible way. And it was actually, so instead of telling you guys a jail story, I'm telling you a weird, I connected with people story. And that's all it is for me, guys. That's all I have for you, so...
That was Devin Davis from the Narrator's live open mic. The last story I wanted to share is from Adam Caton Holland, who is a great comedian. And he told this story at a Narrator show last year, and the theme was integrity. And I liked it so much, I wanted to record it again. So this is from the Narrator's Integrity show, and I recorded it one-on-one. And this is Adam Caton Holland.
I was recently asked to talk about integrity, and when I started thinking about integrity, I started thinking about the place where I went for elementary and middle school, which was a school called Grayland Country Day School in Denver, Colorado, which wasn't so much as a school as it was a fascist outpost where lacrosse players were manufactured. I didn't like the kids at Grayland. They didn't like me. We were from different neighborhoods, and they would let me know they didn't like me by calling me names like faggot. And, also, hey, look, there goes the faggot. And that drove the point home. But I was able to kind of get through it all because there was a girl from my neighborhood who was sort of an outcast as well, and her name was Nora. And, I don't know, together, that school seemed a lot easier to navigate. And Nora and I were very close. We'd hang out a lot. I think we were, you know, too young to realize that we liked each other, boyfriend-girlfriend style. We were just friends. And I liked her. And I remember the summer before sixth grade year, Nora moved away. Her family moved to Wyoming, and I had to go face Grayland in sixth grade alone. As bad a place as Grayland was, it did cultivate a very healthy respect for academia. Everyone in that school knew they weren't going to get anywhere unless they got into great colleges, and even as fourth, fifth, sixth graders, this was hammered into our heads. And in sixth grade, that respect for academia manifested itself in an insane desire of every student to be published in the Grayland Literary Review, which was a book of poetry curated by Miss Kennedy, who was the best teacher at Grayland. She was a sixth grade teacher who had the kids come in every day and write poetry. That type of cool teacher. So I figured, I know what I'll do. I'll write a poem about how I feel about Nora. I'll get it published in the Grayland Literary Review, and I'll get everyone to stop calling me faggot through the power of my poetry. A plan which has worked in history exactly never. It's worked never times. But I figured I would give it a try. So I want to share the poem that I wrote about Nora. By the way, if you ever need a reason for why you shouldn't take your kids to private school, read the 1992 Grayland Literary Review. Every poem is like, doom, gloom, death, despair. I hope there are churros at lunch. Anyway, my poem is called Friendship. Friendship. You and I will meet in a very odd way. You will find me sailing on the great river of life. How odd. Friends forever we shall be. So we thought. But if I sail away one day, it does not mean the river ends. It only means the river bends. Some pretty heavy stuff from a sixth grader. And if that poem sounds familiar to you, it's because I plagiarized it wholesale from an episode of Charles in Charge. Episode 93, entitled Walter's War, in which Mr. Powell is visited by a flame from his war days, and they hit it off and reconnect. And then in that exact same episode, she dies. And as the credits are scrolling, Mr. Powell is going through former letters that she wrote to him, and he found that doozy of a poem. And watching that on the television, I was floored. And I knew that I felt that exact same way about Nora as Mr. Powell felt about his dead World War II flame. So I figured I'd publish it and see what happened. Didn't really realize that was wrong, just did it. Well, Miss Kennedy was absolutely floored. She said it was the best poem she had ever read in her tenure of helming the Literary Review. She wanted to publish the poem. Not only did she want to publish it, she wanted me to read it at an assembly in front of the entire school the next week. Needless to say, I was sweating bullets. I thought I was going to be caught. But I read it, and no one was the wiser, miraculously. I guess the rest of the students there were busy having friendships and lives, not being raised by 80s sitcoms. So I got away with it, and the poem was published. Everybody loved it. They kept calling me faggot, but still, I got that poem published. And Miss Kennedy asked me to be editor-in-chief of the Literary Review off the strength of that poem for the next year. Of course, I said yes. Did a pretty good job editing that Literary Review. She had me do it again the following year. Bam, 2 years, editor, Grayland Literary Review. When I got to high school, I decided to work for the newspaper. When it came time to apply for editor jobs, they asked if I had any editing experience. I was like, yeah, 2 years, editing the Grayland Literary Review. Perhaps you've heard of it. Got that job, became editor-in-chief, went on to college, wrote for my college newspaper off the strength of my high school newspaper experience. Got out into the real world, started writing for an alt-weekly, had a column, learned about storytelling, got kind of a fan base. It allowed me to learn how to communicate with people and do shows like this, where I can share my views on the world. So I guess when asked to talk about integrity, I gotta say it's pretty fucking overrated.
That was Adam Caton Holland speaking on integrity, and that's it for the September minicast. I'll be back in a few weeks with the October Narrators Podcast, and the theme for that show is Things I've Lost.